right away. But Giliola spread her towel, along with Michele's, carefully on the sand, placed her purse on it, cigarettes, lighter, said to her brother, "Lie down on the hot sand because the wind's blowing. Your bathing suit's wet and you'll catch cold." What to do? I made an effort not to look toward the sea, as if in that way it wouldn't occur to them to look at it. And I paid happy attention to Michele, who started talking in his usual, unemotional, careless tone. They had taken a holiday. It was too hot in Naples. Boat in the morning, boat in the evening, good air. Since Pinuccia and Alfonso were in the shop on the Piazza dei Martiri, or rather, no, Alfonso and Pinuccia, because Pinuccia didn't do much, while Alfonso was great. It was on Pina's recommendation that they had decided to come to Forio. "You'll find them," she had said, "just walk along the beach." And in fact, they had walked and walked. Giliola had shouted, "Isn't that Linuccia?" And here we are. I kept saying, "What a pleasure," and meanwhile, Michele got up absent-mindedly, with his sandy feet on Giliola's towel, so she reproached him. "Pay a little attention," but in vain. Now that he had finished the story of why they were on Ischia, I knew that the real question was about to arrive. I read it in his eyes, even before he said it. "Where's Lena?"
"She's swimming."
"In this sea?"
"It's not too rough."
It was inevitable. Both he and Giliola turned to look at the sea, with its curls of foam. But they did it distractedly. They were settling themselves on the towels. Michele argued with the boy, who wanted to go swimming again. "Stay here," he said. "You want to drown?" He stuck a comic book in his hand, adding to his girlfriend, "We're never taking him again." Giliola complimented me profusely. "How well you look, all tanned, and your hair is even lighter." I smiled. I was self-deprecating, but I was thinking only, "I've got to find a way to get them out of here." "Come rest at the house," I said. "Nunzia's there. She'll be very happy." They refused. They had to catch the boat in a couple of hours. They preferred to have a little more sun, and then they would head off on their walk. "So let's go to the bathhouse. We'll get something to eat there," I said. "Yes, but let's wait for Lena." As always in tense situations, I undertook to blot out the time with words, and I started off with a flurry of questions, anything that came into my head. How was Spagnuolo the pastry maker? How was Marcello? If he'd found a girlfriend? What did Michele think of the shoe designs? And what did his father think? And what did his mama think of them? And what did his grandfather think? At one point, I got up. I said, "I'll call Lena." And I went down to the water's edge. I began to shout, "Lena, come back! Michele and Giliola are here." But it was useless. She didn't hear me. I went back and started talking again to distract them. I hoped that Lila and Nino, returning to shore, would become aware of the danger before Giliola and Michele saw them and avoid any intimate attitude. But though Giliola listened to me, Michele wasn't even polite enough to pretend. He had come to Ischia purposely to see Lila and talk to her about the new shoes. I was sure of it. And he cast long glances at the sea, which was getting rougher. Finally, he saw her. He saw her as she came out of the water, her hand entwined in Nino's, a handsome couple who would not pass unobserved, both tall, both naturally elegant, shoulders touching, smiles exchanged. They were so entranced with themselves that they didn't immediately realize I had company. When Lila recognized Michele and pulled her hand away, it was too late. Maybe Giliola didn't notice, and her brother was reading the comic book. but Michele saw, and turned to look at me as if to read on my face the verification of what he had just had before his eyes. He must have found it in the form of fear. He said gravely, in the slow voice that he assumed when he had to deal with something that required speed and decisiveness, 10 minutes, just the time to say hello and we'll go. In fact, they stayed more than an hour. Michele, when he heard Nino's last name, introducing him, I placed great emphasis on the fact that he was our schoolmate in elementary school, as well as my classmate in high school, asked the most irritating question. You're the son of the guy who writes for Roma and for Napoli Notte? Nino nodded unwillingly, and Michele stared at him for a long instant, as if he wanted to find in his eyes confirmation of that relationship. Then he did not speak to him again. He spoke only and always to Lila. Lila was friendly, ironic, at times deceitful. Michele said to her, That blowhard your brother swears he thought up the new shoes.
It's the truth.
So that's why they're garbage.
You'll see. That garbage will sell even better than the preceding.
Maybe, but only if you come to the store.
You already have Giliola, who's doing great.
I need Giliola in the pastry shop.
Your problem. I have to stay in the grocery.
You'll see. You'll move to Piazza dei Martiri, Signor, and you'll have carte blanche.
Carte blanche, carte noire, get it out of your head. I'm fine where I am. And so on in this tone,
they seemed to be playing tamburello with their words. Every so often Giliola or I tried to say something, mainly Giliola, who was furious at the way her fiancé talked about her fate without even consulting her. As for Nino, he was, I realized, stunned. Or perhaps astonished at how Lila, skillful and fearless, found the phrases in dialect to match Michele's. Finally, the young Solara announced that they had to go. They had an umbrella with their belongings quite far away. He said goodbye to me. He said goodbye warmly to Lila, repeating that he would expect her in the store in September. To Nino, he said seriously, as if to a subordinate whom one asks to go and buy a pack of nationals, Tell your papa that he was wrong to write that he didn't like the way the store looked. When you take money, you have to write that everything's great. Otherwise, no more money. Nino was caught by surprise, perhaps by humiliation, and didn't answer. Giliola held out her hand. He gave her his mechanically. The couple went off, dragging the boy, who was reading the comic book as he walked. 68. I was enraged, frightened, unhappy with my every word or gesture. As soon as Michele and Giliola were far enough away, I said to Lila, so that Nino could also hear me, He saw you. Nino asked uneasily, Who is he?
A shit Camorrist who thinks he's God's gift, said Lila contemptuously.
I corrected her immediately. Nino should know. He's one of her husband's partners. He'll tell Stefano everything.
What everything? Lila protested. There's nothing to tell.
You know perfectly well that they'll tell on you.
Yes, and who gives a damn?
I give a damn.
Don't worry, because even if you won't help me, things will go as they should go.
And as if I weren't present, she went on to make arrangements with Nino for the next day. But while she, precisely because of that encounter with Michele Solara, seemed to have multiplied her energies, he seemed like a wind-up toy that has run down. He murmured, Are you sure you won't get yourself in trouble because of me?
Lila caressed his cheek. You don't want to anymore?
The caress seemed to revive him. I'm just worried for you. We soon left Nino,
we returned home. Along the way, I sketched catastrophic scenarios. Michele will talk to Stefano tonight. Stefano will rush over here tomorrow morning. He won't find you at home. Nunzio will send him to Burano. He won't find you at Burano either. You'll lose everything, Lila. Listen to me. You'll ruin not only yourself, but you'll ruin me too. My mother will kill me. But she confined herself to listening absent-mindedly, smiling, repeating in varying formulations a single idea. I love you, Lainu, and I will always love you. So I hope that you feel at least once in your life what I'm feeling at this moment. Then I thought, so much the worse for you. We stayed home that night. Lila was nice to her mother. She wanted to cook. She wanted her to be served. She cleared, washed the dishes, sat on her lap, put her arms around her neck, resting her forehead against hers with an unexpected sadness. Nunzia, who wasn't used to those kindnesses and must have found them embarrassing, at a certain point burst into tears, and amid her tears uttered a phrase convoluted by anxiety. Please, Lena, no mother has ever had a daughter like you. Don't make me die of sorrow. Lila made fun of her affectionately and took her to her room. In the morning, she dragged me out of bed. Part of me was so anguished that it didn't want to get up and be conscious of the day. In the minicab to Forio, I laid out other terrible scenarios that left her completely indifferent. Nella's gone. Nella really has guests and has no room for me. The Sadatores decide to come here to Forio to visit their son. She continued to reply in a joking tone. If Nella's gone, Nino's mother will welcome you. If there's no room, you'll come back and sleep at our house. If the whole Sadatore family knocks at the door of Bruno's house, we won't open it. And we went on like that until, a little before 9, we arrived at our destination. Nino was at the window waiting. He hurried to open the door. He gave me a nod of greeting. He drew Lila inside. What, until that door could still be avoided, from that moment became an unstoppable mechanism. In the same cab, at Lila's expense, I was taken to Burano. On the way, I realized that I couldn't truly hate them. I felt bitterness toward Nino. I certainly had some hostile feelings toward Lila. I could even wish death on both of them. But almost as a kind of incantation that was capable, paradoxically, of saving all three of us. Hatred, no. Rather, I hated myself. I despised myself. I was there. I was there on the island. The air stirred by the cab's movement assailed me with the intense odors of the vegetation from which night was evaporating. But it was a mortified presence, submissive to the demands of others. I was living in them, unobtrusively. I couldn't cancel out the images of the embraces, kisses in the empty house. Their passion invaded me, disturbed me. I loved them both, and so I couldn't love myself, feel myself, affirm myself with a need for life of my own. One that had the same blind, mute force as theirs. So it seemed to me. 69. I was greeted by Nella and the Sadatore family with the usual enthusiasm. I assumed my humblest mask, the mask of my father when he collected tips, the elaborate mask of my forebears, always fearful, always subordinate, always pleasingly willing, by which to avoid danger. And I went from lie to lie in a pleasant manner. I said to Nella that if I had decided to come and disturb her, it wasn't by choice, but necessity. I said that the Caracis had guests, that there was no room for me that night. I said that I hoped I hadn't presumed too much in showing up like this, unexpectedly, and that if there were difficulties, I would return to Naples for a few days. Nella embraced me, fed me, swearing that to have me in the house was an immense pleasure for her. I refused to go to the beach with the Sadatores, although the children protested. Lydia insisted that I join them soon, and Donato declared that he would wait for me so we could swim together. I stayed with Nella, helping her straighten the house, cook lunch. For a moment, everything weighed on me less. The lies, the images of the adultery that was taking place, my complicity. A jealousy that couldn't be defined because I felt at the same time jealous of Lila, who was giving herself to Nino. Of Nino, who was giving himself to Lila. In the meantime, Nella, talking about the Sadatores, seemed less hostile. She said that husband and wife had found an equilibrium, and since they were getting along, they gave her less trouble. She told me about Maestra Oliviero. She had telephoned her in order to tell her that I had come to see her, and she had been very tired, but more optimistic. For a while, in other words, there was a tranquil flow of news. But a few remarks were enough, an unexpected detour, and the weight of the situation I was involved in returned forcefully. "She praised you a lot," Nella said, speaking of Maestra Oliviero. "But when she found out that you came to see me with your two married friends, she asked a lot of questions, especially about Signora Lina." "What did she say?" "She said that in her entire career as a teacher, she never had such a good student." The evocation of Lila's old primacy disturbed me. "It's true," I admitted. But Nella made a grimace of absolute disagreement. Her eyes lit up. "My cousin is an exceptional teacher," she said. "And yet, in my view, this time she is wrong." "No, she's not wrong." "Can I tell you what I think?" "Of course." "It won't upset you?" "No." "I didn't like Signora Lina. You are much better. You're prettier and more intelligent. I talked about it with the Sadatores, too, and they agree with me."
"You say that because you love me."
"No. Pay attention, Lenu. I know that you are good friends, my cousin told me, and I don't want to interfere in things that have nothing to do with me. But a glance is enough for me to judge people. Signora Lina knows that you're better than her, and so she doesn't love you the way you love her." I smiled, pretending skepticism. "Does she hate me?" "I don't know. But she knows how to wound. It's written in her face. It's enough to look at her forehead and her eyes." I shook my head. I repressed my satisfaction. Ah, if it were all so straightforward. But I already knew, although not the way I do today, that between the two of us everything was more tangled. And I joked, laughed, made Nella laugh. I told her that Lila never made a good impression the first time. Since she was little, she had seemed like a devil, and she really was, but in a good way. She had a quick mind and did well in whatever she happened to apply herself to. If she could have studied, she would have become a scientist like Madame Curie, or a great novelist like Grazia Deleda, or even like Neil de Jotti, the lover of Togliatti. And hearing those last two names, Nella exclaimed, "Oh, Madonna," and ironically made the sign of the cross. Then she gave a little laugh, then another, and she couldn't contain herself. She wanted to whisper a secret, a very funny thing that Sadatore had said to her. Lila, according to him, had an almost ugly beauty, a type that males are, yes, enchanted by, but also fear. "What fear?" I asked, also in a low voice. And she, in an even lower voice, "The fear that their thingy won't function, or it will fall off,
or she'll pull out a knife and cut it off.
She laughed. Her chest heaved. Her eyes became teary. She couldn't contain herself for quite some time, and I felt an unease I had never felt with her before. It wasn't my mother's laughter, the obscene laughter of the woman who knows. In Nella's, there was something chaste and yet vulgar. It was the laugh of an aging virgin that assailed me and pushed me to laugh too, but in a forced way. A smart woman like her, I said to myself. Why does this amuse her? And meanwhile, I saw myself growing old, with that laugh of malicious innocence in my breast. I thought, I'll end up laughing like that, too.
70. The Saratores arrived for lunch. They left a trail of sand on the floor, an odor of sea and sweat, a light-hearted reproach because the children had waited for me in vain. I set the table, cleared, washed the dishes, followed Pino, Clelia, and Ciro to the edge of a thicket to help them cut reeds to make a kite. With the children, I was happy, while their parents rested, while Nella napped on a lounge chair on the terrace. The time slipped by. The kite absorbed me completely. I scarcely thought of Nino and Lila. In the late afternoon, we all went to the beach, even Nella, to fly the kite. I ran back and forth on the beach, followed by the three children, who were silent, amazed, when the kite appeared to rise, and they cried out when they saw it hit the sand after an unexpected pirouette. I kept trying, but I couldn't make it fly, in spite of the instructions that Donato shouted to me from under the umbrella. Finally, all sweaty, I gave up, and said to Pino, Clelia, and Ciro, "Ask Papa." Dragged by his children, Saratore came and checked the weave of the reeds, the blue tissue paper, the thread. Then he studied the wind and began to run backward, leaping energetically, despite his heavy body. The children ran beside him in their excitement, and I also revived. I began to run along with them, until their expanding happiness was transmitted to me, too. Our kite traveled higher and higher. It flew. There was no need to run. You had only to hold the string. Saratore was a good father. He demonstrated that with his help, Ciro could hold it, and Clelia, and Pino, and even me. He handed it to me, in fact, but he stood behind me. He breathed on my neck and said, "Like that. Good. Pull a little. Let it go." And it was evening. We had dinner. The Saratore family went for a walk in the town, husband, wife, and three children, sunburned and dressed up. Although they urged me to come, I stayed with Nella. We cleaned up. She helped me make the bed in the usual corner of the kitchen. We sat on the terrace in the cool air. The moon wasn't visible. In the dark sky, there were swells of white clouds. We talked about how pretty and intelligent the Saratore children were, and Nella fell asleep. Then, suddenly, the day, the night that was beginning, fell on me. I left the house on tiptoe. I went toward the Maronti. Who knows if Michele Solara had kept to himself what he had seen? Who knows if everything was going smoothly? Who knows if Nunzia was already asleep in the house on the road in Quarto, or was trying to calm her son-in-law, who had arrived unexpectedly on the last boat, hadn't found his wife, and was furious? Who knows if Lila had telephoned her husband and reassured that he was in Naples, far away, in the apartment in the new neighborhood, was now in bed with Nino, without fear. A secret couple. A couple intent on enjoying the night. Everything in the world was in precarious balance. Pure risk. And those who didn't agree to take the risk wasted away in a corner, without getting to know life. I understood suddenly why I hadn't had Nino, why Leela had had him. I wasn't capable of entrusting myself to true feelings. I didn't know how to be drawn beyond the limits. I didn't possess that emotional power that had driven Leela to do all she could to enjoy that day and that night. I stayed behind, waiting. She, on the other hand, seized things, truly wanted them, was passionate about them, played for all or nothing, and wasn't afraid of contempt, mockery, spitting, beatings. She deserved Nino, in other words, because she thought that to love him meant to try to have him, not to hope that he would want her. I made the dark descent. Now the moon was visible amid scattered pale-edged clouds. The evening was very fragrant, and you could hear the hypnotic rhythm of the waves. On the beach, I took off my shoes. The sand was cold. A gray-blue light extended as far as the sea, and then spread over its tremulous expanse. I thought, yes, Leela is right. The beauty of things is a trick. The sky is the throne of fear. I'm alive, now, here, 10 steps from the water, and it is not at all beautiful. It's terrifying. Along with this beach, the sea, the swarm of animal forms, I am part of the universal terror. At this moment, I'm the infinitesimal particle through which the fear of everything becomes conscious of itself. I, who listen to the sound of the sea, who feel the dampness and the cold sand. I, who imagine all Ischia, the entwined bodies of Nino and Leela, Stefano sleeping by himself in the new house that is increasingly not so new, the Furies who indulge the happiness of today to feel the violence of tomorrow. Ah, it's true, my fear is too great, and so I hope that everything will end soon, that the figures of the nightmares will consume my soul. I hope that from this darkness packs of mad dogs will emerge, vipers, scorpions, enormous sea serpents. I hope that while I'm sitting here, on the edge of the sea, assassins will arrive out of the night and torture my body. Yes, let me be punished for my insufficiency. Let the worst happen. Something so devastating that it will prevent me from facing tonight, tomorrow, the hours and days to come, reminding me with always more crushing evidence of my unsuitable constitution. Thoughts like that I had, the frenzied thoughts of girlish discouragement. I gave myself up to them for I don't know how long. Then someone said, "Leela," and touched my shoulder with cold fingers. I started. An icy grip seized my heart. And when I turned suddenly and recognized Donato Salvatore, the breath burst in my throat like the sip of a magic potion, the kind that in poems revives strength and the urge to live. 71. Donato told me that Nella had awakened, found that I wasn't in the house, and was worried. Lydia, too, was a little alarmed, so she had asked him to go and look for me. The only one who had found it normal that I wasn't in the house was him. He had reassured the two women. He had said, "Go to sleep. Surely she's gone to enjoy the moon on the beach." Yet, to please them, out of prudence, he had come on a reconnaissance. And in fact, here I was, sitting and listening to the sea's breath, contemplating the divine beauty of the sky. He spoke like that, more or less. He sat beside me. He murmured that he knew me as he knew himself. We had the same sensitivity to beautiful things, the same need to enjoy them, the same need to search for the right words to say how sweet the night was, how magical the moon, how the sea sparkled, How two souls were able to meet and recognize each other in the darkness, in the fragrant air. As he spoke, I heard clearly the ridiculousness of his strained voice, the crudeness of his poeticizing, the sleazy lyricizing behind which he concealed his eagerness to put his hands on me. But I thought, maybe we really are made of the same clay. Maybe we really are condemned, blameless, to the same identical mediocrity. So I rested my head on his shoulder. I murmured, "I'm cold." And he quickly put an arm around my waist, pulled me slowly closer to him, asked me if it was better like that. I answered, "Yes," a whisper. And Saratore lifted my chin with thumb and index finger, placed his lips lightly on mine, asked, "How's that?" Then he pressed me with little kisses that grew in intensity as he continued to murmur, "And like that, and like that. Are you still cold? Is it better like that? Is it better?" His mouth was warm and wet. I welcomed it on mine with increasing gratitude, so that the kiss lasted longer and longer. His tongue grazed mine, collided with it, sank into my mouth. I felt better. I realized that I was regaining ground, that the ice was ceding, melting, that the fear was forgetting itself, that his hands were taking away the cold, but slowly, as if it were made of very thin layers, and Saratore had the ability to peel them away with cautious precision, one by one, without tearing them, and that his mouth, too, had that capacity, and his teeth, his tongue, and he therefore knew much more about me than Antonio had ever learned, that, in fact, he knew what I myself didn't know. I had a hidden me, I realized, that fingers, mouth, teeth, tongue were able to discover. Layer after layer, that me lost every hiding place, was shamelessly exposed, and Saratore showed that he knew how to keep it from fleeing, from being ashamed. He knew how to hold it as if it were the absolute reason for his affectionate motility, for his sometimes gentle, sometimes fevered pressures. The entire time, I didn't once regret having accepted what was happening. I had no second thoughts, and I was proud of myself. I wanted it to be like that. I imposed it on myself. I was helped, perhaps, by the fact that Saratore progressively forgot his flowery language, that, unlike Antonio, he claimed no intervention from me. He never took my hand to touch him, but confined himself to convincing me that he liked everything about me, and he applied himself to my body with the care, the devotion, the pride of the man absorbed in demonstrating how thoroughly he knows women. I didn't even hear him say, "You're a virgin." Probably he was so sure of my condition that he would have been surprised by the opposite. When I was overwhelmed by a need for pleasure so demanding and so egocentric that it canceled out not only the entire world of sensation, but also his body, in my eyes old, and the labels by which he could be classified, father of Nino, railway worker, poet, journalist, Donato Saratore, he was aware of it and penetrated me. I felt that he did it delicately at first. Then, with a clear and decisive thrust that caused a rip in my stomach, a stab of pain immediately erased by a rhythmic oscillation, a sliding, a thrusting, an emptying and filling me with jolts of eager desire, until suddenly he withdrew, turned over on his back on the sand, and emitted a sort of strangled roar. We were silent. The sea returned, the tremendous sky. I felt stunned. That impelled Satatori again toward his coarse lyricism. He thought he had to lead me back to myself with tender words. But I managed to tolerate at most a couple of phrases. I got up abruptly, shook the sand out of my hair, off my whole body, straightened myself. When he ventured, "Where can we meet tomorrow?" I answered in Italian, in a calm voice, self-assured, that he was mistaken. He must never look for me again, not at Cetara or in the neighborhood. And when he smiled skeptically, I told him that what Antonio Cappuccio, Melina's son, could do to him was nothing in comparison to what Michele Solara, a person I knew well, would do. I need only say a word, and Solara would make things very hard for him. I told him that Michele was eager to bash his face in, because he had taken money to write about the shop on Piazza dei Martiri, but hadn't done his job well. All the way back I continued to threaten him, partly because he had returned to his sugary, sweet little phrases, and I wanted him to understand clearly my feelings, partly because I was amazed at how the tonality of threat, which since I was a child I had used only in dialect, came easily to me also in the Italian language. 72. I was afraid I would find the two women awake, but they were both asleep. They weren't so worried that they would lose sleep. They considered me sensible. They trusted me. I slept deeply. The next day I woke up cheerful, and even when Nino, Lila, and what had happened at the Maranti came back to me, in fragments, I still felt good. I chatted a long time with Nella, had breakfast with the Saratores, didn't mind the falsely paternal kindness with which Donato treated me. Not for a moment did I think that sex with that rather conceited, vain, garrulous man had been a mistake. Yet to see him there at the table, to listen to him, and recognize that it was he who had deflowered me, disgusted me. I went to the beach with the whole family. I went swimming with the children. I left behind me a wake of fondness. I arrived punctually at Forio. I called Nino. He appeared immediately. I refused to go in, partly because we had to leave as soon as possible, partly because I did not want to preserve images of rooms that Nino and Lila had inhabited by themselves for almost 2 days. I waited. Lila didn't come. Suddenly my anxiety returned. I imagined that Stefano had been able to leave in the morning, that he was disembarking several hours earlier than expected, and in fact was already on his way to the house. I called again. Nino returned. He indicated that I had to wait just another minute. They came down a quarter of an hour later. They embraced and kissed for a long time in the entrance. Lila ran toward me, but she stopped suddenly as if she had forgotten something, and went back and kissed him again. I looked away uneasily, and the idea that there was something wrong with me, that I lacked a true capacity for involvement, regained strength. Yet the two of them again seemed to me so handsome, perfect in every movement, that to cry, "Lina, hurry up," was almost to disfigure a fantastical image. She seemed drawn away by a cruel force. Her hand ran slowly from his shoulder, along the arm, to the fingers, as if in the movement of a dance. Finally, she joined me. We hardly spoke during the ride in the minicab. "Everything all right?"
"Yes. And you?"
"Fine." I said nothing about myself, nor did she about herself. But the reasons for that reticence were very different. I had no intention of putting into words what had happened to me. It was a bare fact. It had to do with my body, its physiological reactivity.
That for the first time, a tiny part of another body had entered it seemed to me irrelevant. The nighttime mass of Saratore communicated to me nothing, except a sensation of alienness, and it was a relief that it had vanished like a storm that never arrives. It seemed to me clear, instead, that Leela was silent because she didn't have words. I felt she was in a state without thoughts or images, as if in detaching herself from Nino, she had forgotten in him everything of herself, even the capacity to say what had happened to her, what was happening. This difference between us made me sad. I tried to search in my experience on the beach for something equivalent to her sorrowful, happy disorientation. I also realized that at the Moranti, in Barano, I had left nothing, not even that new self that had been revealed. I had taken everything with me, and so I didn't feel the urgency, which I read in Leela's eyes, in her half-closed mouth, in her clenched fists, to go back, to be reunited with the person I had had to leave. And if on the surface my condition might seem more solid, more compact, here, instead, beside Leela, I felt sodden, earth too soaked with water. 73. Fortunately, I didn't read her notebooks until later. There were pages and pages about that day and night with Nino, and what those pages said was exactly what I hadn't had and couldn't say. Leela wrote not even a word about sexual pleasures, nothing that might be useful in comparing her experience with mine. She talked instead about love, and she did so in a surprising way. She said that from the day of her marriage until those days on Ischia, she had been, without realizing it, on the point of dying. She described minutely a sensation of imminent death, lack of energy, lethargy, a strong pressure in the middle of her head, as if between the brain and the skull there was an air bubble that was continually expanding. The impression that everything was moving in a hurry to leave, that the speed of every movement of persons and things was excessive and hit her, wounded her, caused her physical pain in her stomach and in her eyes. She said that all this was accompanied by a dulling of the senses, as if they had been wrapped in cotton wool, and her wounds came not from the real world, but from a hollow space between her body and the mass of cotton wool in which she felt she was wrapped. She admitted, on the other hand, that imminent death seemed to her so assured that it took away her respect for everything, above all for herself, as if nothing counted anymore, and everything deserved to be ruined. At times she was overwhelmed by a mania to express herself with no mediation, express herself for the last time, before becoming like Melina, before crossing the Stradone just as a truck was coming, and be hit, dragged away. Nino had changed that state. He had snatched her away from death. And he had done it when he had asked her to dance at Professor Galliani's house, and she had refused, frightened by that offer of salvation. Then, on Ischia, day by day, he had assumed the power of the Savior. He had restored to her the capacity to feel. He had, above all, brought back to life her sense of herself. Yes, brought to life. Lines and lines and lines had at their center the concept of resurrection, an ecstatic rising, the end of every bond, and yet the inexpressible pleasure of a new bond. A revival that was also a revolt. He and she and he together learned life again, banished its poison, reinvented it as the pure joy of thinking and living. This, more or less,
Her words were very beautiful. Mine are only a summary. If she had confided it to me then, in the taxi, I would have suffered even more. Because I would have recognized in her fulfillment the reverse of my emptiness. I would have understood that she had come to something that I thought I knew, that I had believed I felt for Nino, and that, instead, I didn't know, and perhaps would never know, except in a weak, muted form. I would have understood that she wasn't playing a summer game for fun, but that a violent feeling was growing inside her and would overwhelm her. Instead, as we were returning to Nunzia after our violations, I couldn't get away from the usual confused sense of disparity, the impression, recurrent in our story, that I was losing something and she was gaining. So occasionally I felt the need to even the score, to tell her how I had lost my virginity between sea and sky, at night, on the beach at Maranti. I couldn't tell her the name of Nino's father, I thought. I could invent a sailor, a smuggler of American cigarettes, and tell her what had happened to me, tell her how good it had been. But I realized that to tell her about me and my pleasure didn't matter to me. I would tell my story only to induce her to tell hers, and find out how much pleasure she had had with Nino, and compare it with mine, and feel, I hoped, in the lead. Luckily, I sensed that she would never do it, and that I would only have stupidly exposed myself. I remained silent, as she did.
74. Once we were home, Leela found words again, along with an oversighted expansiveness. Nunzia welcomed us, greatly relieved by our return, and yet hostile. She said she hadn't closed an eye. She had heard inexplicable noises in the house, had been afraid of ghosts and murderers. Leela embraced her, and Nunzia almost pushed her away.
"Did you have fun?" she asked.
"A lot of fun. I want to change everything."
"What do you want to change?"
Leela laughed. "I'll think about it and let you know."
"Let your husband know first of all," Nunzia said in an unexpectedly sharp tone. Her daughter looked at her in amazement, a pleased and perhaps slightly moved amazement, as if the suggestion seemed to her right and urgent.
"Yes," she said, and went to her room, then to the bathroom.
She came out after a while, and, still in her slip, motioned me to come to her room. I went reluctantly. She gazed at me with feverish eyes. She spoke rapidly, almost breathlessly.
"I want to study what he studies."
"He's at the university. The subjects are difficult."
"I want to read the same books as him. I want to understand the things he thinks. I want to learn not for the university, but for him."
"Leela, don't act crazy. We said that you would see him this time, and that's all. What's wrong with you? Calm down. Stefano is about to get here."
"Do you think if I work hard, I can understand the things he understands?"
I couldn't take it anymore. What I already knew, and what I nevertheless was hiding from myself, became at that moment perfectly clear. She, too, now saw in Nino the only person able to save her. She had taken possession of my old feeling, had made it her own. And knowing what she was like, I had no doubts. She would knock down every obstacle and continue to the end. I answered harshly, "No. It's complicated stuff. You're too behind in everything. You don't read a newspaper. You don't know who's in the government. You don't even know who runs Naples."
"And do you know those things?"
"No."
"He thinks you know them. I told you. He thinks a lot of you."
I felt myself flushing. I muttered, "I'm trying to learn. And when I don't know, I pretend to know."
"Even pretending to know, one gradually learns." Can you help me?
No. And no, Leela. It's not something you should do. Leave him alone. Because of you, he's already saying that he wants to stop going to the university.
He'll study. He was born for that. And yet there are a lot of things that even he doesn't know. If I study the things he doesn't know, I'll tell him when he needs them, and so I'll be useful to him. I have to change, Lainu, immediately. I burst out again.
You're married. You have to get him out of your head. You're not right for what he needs.
Who is right?
I wanted to wound her. I said, Nadia.
He left her for me.
So everything's fine? I don't want to listen to you anymore. You're both out of your minds. Do what you like.
I went to my room, consumed by unhappiness.
75. Stefano arrived at the usual time. We all three greeted him with false cheerfulness, and he was polite, but a little tense, as if behind his benign expression he had a worry. Since his vacation was to begin that day, I was surprised that he hadn't brought any luggage. Leela didn't seem to notice, but Nunzia did and asked him,
You look preoccupied, Stay. Is something worrying you? Is your mama well? And Pinuccia? And how are things with the shoes? What do the Salaras say? Are they pleased?
He said that everything was fine, and we had dinner, but the conversation was forced.
First, Leela made an effort to seem in a good mood. But when Stefano responded with monosyllables and no sign of affection, she became annoyed and was silent. Only Nunzia and I tried every possible means to keep the silence from becoming permanent. When we got to the fruit, Stefano, with a half-smile, said to his wife,
You go swimming with Sadatore's son?
My breath failed. Leela answered with irritation, Sometimes. Why?
How many times? One, two, three, five? How many? Lainu, do you know?
Once, I said. He came by 2 or 3 days ago, and we all went swimming together. Stefano, still with the half-smile on his face, turned to his wife.
And you and the son of Sadatore are so intimate that when you come out of the water you hold hands?
Leela stared straight into his face. Who told you that?
Ada.
And who told Ada?
Giliola.
And Giliola?
Giliola saw you, bitch. She came here with Michele. They came to visit you. And it's not true that you and that piece of shit went swimming with Lainuccia. You went by yourselves, and you were holding hands.
Leela got up. She said calmly, I'm going out. I'm going for a walk.
You are not going anywhere. Sit down and answer.
Leela remained standing. She said suddenly, in Italian and with an expression that looked like weariness, but which, I realized, was contempt. How stupid I was to marry you. You're worthless. You know that Michele Salata wants me in his shop. You know that for that reason Giliola would kill me if she could. And what do? You believe her? I don't want to listen to you anymore. You let yourself be manipulated like a puppet. Lainu, will you come with me? She was about to move toward the door, and I started to get up. But Stefano leaped up and grabbed her by the arm, said to her,
You're not going anywhere. You will tell me if it's true or not that you went swimming by yourself with the son of Sadatore. If it's true or not that you go around holding hands.
Leela tried to free herself, but she couldn't. She whispered, Let go of my arm. You make me sick. Nunzia at that point intervened. She reproached her daughter, said she could not allow herself to say that terrible thing to Stefano. But right afterward, with a surprising energy,
She nearly shouted at her son-in-law to stop it. Leela had already answered. It was envy that made Giliola say those things. The daughter of the pastry maker was treacherous. She was afraid of losing her place in Piazza dei Martiri. She wanted to get rid of Panucci, too, and be the sole mistress of the shop. She, who knew nothing about shoes, who didn't even know how to make pastries, while everything was due to Leela, including the success of the new grocery store. And so her daughter didn't deserve to be treated like that. No, she didn't deserve it. She was truly enraged. Her face was alight, wide-eyed. At one point, she seemed to be suffocating, as she added point to point without taking a breath. But Stefano didn't listen to a word. His mother-in-law was still speaking when he yanked Leela toward the bedroom, yelling, "You will now answer me, immediately!" And when she insulted him grossly and grabbed the door of a cupboard to resist, he pulled her with such force that the door opened. The cupboard tottered dangerously, with a sound of plates and glasses rattling, and Leela almost flew through the kitchen and hit the wall of the hall that led to their room. A moment later, her husband had grabbed her again and, holding her by the arm, but as if he were steadying a cup by the handle, pushed her into the bedroom and closed the door. I heard the key turn in the lock. That sound terrified me. I had seen with my own eyes, in those long moments, that Stefano really was inhabited by the ghost of his father, that the shadow of Don Achille could swell the veins of his neck and the blue network under the skin of his forehead. But although I was frightened, I felt that I couldn't stay still, sitting at the table like Nunzia. I grabbed the doorknob and began to shake it, to pound the wooden door with my fist, begging, "Stefano, please, it's not true. Leave her alone. Stefano, don't hurt her." But by now he was sealed within his rage. I could hear him yelling that he wanted the truth. And since Leela didn't respond, in fact, it was as if she were no longer in the room. He seemed to be talking to himself, and meanwhile, hitting himself, striking himself, breaking things. "I'm going to call the landlady," I said to Nunzia, and I ran down the stairs. I wanted to ask the woman if she had another key, or if her grandson was there, a large man who could have broken down the door. But I knocked in vain. The woman wasn't there. Or if she was, she didn't open the door. Meanwhile, Stefano's shouts shattered the walls, spread through the street, through the reeds, toward the sea. And yet they seemed to find no ears but mine. No one looked out of the neighboring houses. No one came running. All that came was Nunzia's pleas, in a low tone, alternating with the threat that if Stefano continued to hurt her daughter, she would tell Fernando and Rino everything, and they, as God was her witness, would kill him. I ran back. I didn't know what to do. I hurled myself with all the weight of my body against the door. I cried that I had called the police. They were coming. Then, since Leela still showed no signs of life, I shrieked, "Leela, are you all right? Please, Leela, tell me you're all right." Only then did we hear her voice. She spoke not to us, but to her husband, coldly. "You want the truth?" "Yes. The son of Saratore and I go swimming, and we hold hands." "Yes. We go into the deep sea and kiss each other and touch each other." "Yes, I've been fucked by him 100 times, and so I discovered that you're a shit, that you're worthless, that you only demand disgusting things that make me throw up. Is that what you want? Are you happy?" Silence. After those words,
Stefano didn't take a breath. I stopped pounding on the door. Nunzia stopped crying. Outside,